wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Kia ora. Hello.
Kia ora.
We're joined here by Dr. Daniel Thomas for Dear Science this week. How are you going today?
Yeah, I'm great. How are you?
That's great to hear. I'm doing pretty well. All right. It's been pretty good weather. I don't even know. That's such a terrible starting point. We've got some interesting topics on the agenda today, all about interactions, so you say. Our first topic is called Great Minds Think Alike. Yeah. Did you want to talk about this one for us?
Yeah, 100%. Let's jump in here. Think about a close friend in your life. Almost certainly, there are going to be someone who you have a shared interest with. So maybe this is a shared interest in games or books or music or movies, something along these lines.
Any kind of hobby, I suppose.
Yeah, right. But almost certainly you share something with them. But that close friend, probably at some point, they were a stranger to you. And so what you've probably bonded over is your shared interest. So that's kind of the thinking that we'll have in mind for this particular story, that you are strangers with someone at some point, you had some shared interest, and maybe the thing that brought you together was your shared interest. Well, this idea or this ability to bond and create communities is actually really important to us, and it's been super important across all of human history, basically. Early on, our ancestors were establishing hunter-gatherer communities, of course, and the shared interests were things like protecting resources that you would need to stay alive. But it's again, this idea of shared interests, common good, bring us together, we bond over them. Well, today, with the rise of especially social media, online communities are essentially being formed around shared similarities. They might not always be shared interests, but they're often things that are shared. So these might be characteristics like age or gender, ethnicity. It could be shared behaviors or preferences. And there's been a group in UCLA, so University of California in Los Angeles, and they've taken a closer look at actually what might be going on behind the scenes with community formation. So what it is about us that recognizes like for like informs communities. So that's where our story begins. And so a study that was published last week in Nature Human Behavior involved graduate students who had never met each other before. So that's the key, they'd not met previously. And it found that students who responded similarly to the same movie clips before meeting were actually more likely to become friends later on.
Yeah, this makes sense. Do you like the same movies? You probably have similar interests or ideas about the world.
That's right. And so here they're actually going to be using brain scans to make predictions about it. So 41 students who had never met each other before participated in a study where they received an MRI brain scan, some brain imaging, so a magnetic resonance image recording of the brain. And so what this is the brain is obviously a very complex organ, and it lights up in different places in different ways, shows different activities when we are experiencing different things. And here, the researchers actually studied a total of 214 different regions of the brains across these 41 students, so quite a detailed map.
Yeah, for sure.
And they were watching the brain light up while the students, who, again, hadn't met one another, were watching different movies. And these movie clips were things showing things like science or food or sports or environment or social events. So imagine just sitting there scrolling on your phone, watching some clips, and your brain is lighting up and some researchers are mapping and
that
recording.
Would be pretty cool to see, I think.
I mean, the images are amazing of these multicolored brain pictures. But anyway, so they've got these maps. The researchers now have these maps of these 41 participants' brains. And then that's essentially the first day of class. And now these 41 students join the rest of their larger class. And the researchers will then track the social networks that these students will form over time. Yeah, and so it's a big class. It's around 250 students. And about 2 months into the semester, the whole class was surveyed, and what they were interested in knowing or in establishing was the social networks that had formed inside of that class. And so they're calculating things like the degree of difference. So if you are a friend with someone, you are 1 degree separated in your social network. And if you're a friend of a friend, you're 2 degrees separated, this kind of thing.
I think in New Zealand, everyone's 1 to 2 degrees separation from each other.
Yeah. There's no more than like 6 degrees difference between anyone.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. And so, especially
in this class.
Yeah, and they were also then asked to do the same thing 6 months down the line. So
yeah, okay.
So this is the setup. Before the students had met, map the brain, get the activity while they're experiencing different things, and then at a couple of time points across the semester, figure out who they are friends with. And I think you can kind of see where this is going. Mm-hmm. So the social networks of the classmates were then figured out, and the participants who became closer over time, who became direct friends, sure enough, they had similar brain activities. So when the researchers were mapping and studying activity in the brain, they were able to see the different regions that would light up. And the students who had essentially the same or very similar regions light up, those were the ones who were fated to become friends.
Wow, that's very cool.
Yeah, and there's a particular region of the brain that lit up. So the left orbitofrontal cortex, so a region associated with social decision-making, turned out to be an incredibly important predictor for becoming friends with that person later on. So if that lit up when you were watching cat videos, then those people would pair off and become friends down the track.
Were cat videos included in this, or what kind of movie clips were we talking about here?
That is my random example. I'm not entirely sure if cats were mentioned. It's just broad categories.
But yeah, I see.
I figure that if science, food and sports are in there, I'm sure cat videos could have
been part of it. Everyone loves a cat video. I think that's a pretty good indicator.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is just about movies. Were there TV shows? Were there books or movies or other hobbies? Have they done any research about that?
So there has been research in that broader field. Mm-hmm. For this particular one, it was just short clips from movies that were being shown. And the real point of difference with this one is it was a controlled group, and the study was done before the participants had met.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than trying to reconstruct it all after they have potentially formed their social network, this had that time zero point, which was really critical for this.
Yeah, for sure. It makes Letterboxd seem like a pretty good way to meet people.
Yeah,
maybe I should get
definitely.
More into that one. We'll move on to our next topic. You've got this study about apes. Do you want to talk about what they've found out here?
Yeah, 100%. So I'm going to start off slightly left field here, though.
Right on.
Have you ever played peekaboo with a really little kid?
Yeah, of course.
Not that I can remember.
Okay.
So, I mean, here's the idea. You cover your face and to a child sitting in front of you, and then reveal yourself again.
And they're absolutely enamored every time. They didn't realize you were still there behind the hands.
Yeah, exactly. And so what's going on here is that this game, this peekaboo, is actually thought to be demonstrating a very young child's inability to understand object permanence.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yeah, so object permanence is that where we know that something still exists, even if we can't see it. You might not be looking at your shoes right now, but you know that they're probably still on your feet.
What about peripheral vision? I can't. I can see my
slightly different thing, but
I can see them slightly, but they're not clearly.
That general idea. Okay, so object permanence. It obviously it matters, and it's a huge part of human society. That is, we know that things still exist even if we can't see them. But the interesting thing about us is we have to learn that. We're not inherently born with it. It's something that we develop through as we age. And hence it works so well with little kids, because when we cover ourselves, we disappear from the known universe.
Mm-hmm.
And then we reappear and it's miraculous. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that's point number one, object permanence. And it's very important to our social intelligence. It's how we keep track of multiple people who are familiar to us, even if they're out of sight. So when did this evolve? Is it something that's very important and just part of being a human? Or is it something that's that we had in our deeper ancestors and that we inherited from a non-human ancestor.
Yeah, right.
And so that's the question that has been asked of in this study. So I've got another question for you before I leap into it, and that is, do you know what a bonobo is?
No.
All right. Do you know what a chimpanzee is?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Is it a type? So the bonobo is a type of ape or a monkey,
yeah,
I suppose.
Exactly.
So I see.
A bonobo and a chimpanzee, they are very closely related to one another, and so by extension, we're closely related to bonobos.
Yeah.
And so a bonobo is the center of our story this week. A new study from Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore explored this idea of by testing a particular bonobo, Kanzi, who's a 42-year-old male bonobo housed in the Ape Cognition and Conservation Center in Des Moines, Iowa, in the United States. They played hide and seek.
Mm-hmm.
So the researchers set up three barriers, and two of the people that work with Kanzi, so two of the caregivers, would hide behind two of the three barriers. And then a third person, the experimenter, would come along and hold up an image of one of the caregivers and go, where is this person, Kanzi? So would actually interact with Kanzi to get Kanzi to identify where the caregiver that was being shown was.
Oh, okay, clever. I was confused about how they would test this. This is kind of that makes sense though.
Yeah, so it's that third person that's really critical to this while the two others are hiding. And Kanzi would point out where the caregiver who had shown in the figure in the picture was hiding. And Kanzi would make mistakes, but more often than not would get it right, and it was better than random. So Kanzi was doing a really good job of actually showing that it knew where the person was hiding.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see how this relates to object permanence. So when those caregivers had stepped away, Kanzi had kept track and knew exactly where they were.
They'd also, I was reading that they tested this over a long time. Like they could remember people that, or other monkeys, I suppose, that they hadn't seen in a little while. How do they find that out?
Yeah, so that I'm actually unclear of, but it's obviously a bigger and a much very important to the social intelligence, if you like, of bonobos. Being able to keep track, not just inside of that single session, but longer. Because this matters. If you're part of a big troop and your part of your troops are out exploring other parts of the very dense forest, and then you come back in, you've got to know that actually they were a member of your troop and they hadn't just fallen off the face of the universe. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. We've got one more topic to talk about today before the end of Dear Science. We've got spiders and fireflies in this final story. Want to tell us what's going on here?
Yeah, sure thing. So this is my third of my interactions. So the first was our friendships, so people interacting, and the second was hide and seek with the bonobo. Well, this one's a little different. This is fireflies. So fireflies aren't something that we have in Aotearoa. These are actually a type of beetle. And
do we not have them in New Zealand?
No, I've never seen them.
Oh, my gosh. I did not know that. We have, like, glowworms, I suppose.
Oh, we've got lots of mosquitoes, of course.
Sorry. Tell us your story.
No, that's great. So glowworms, absolutely. We have glowworms, and they do something very similar. Mm-hmm. They light up with a part of their anatomy, experiencing this chemical reaction, but we don't have little beetles flying around lighting up.
Yeah.
But they are fairly common around the world. So fireflies will fly and flash their abdomens in a particular pattern as a courtship ritual.
Flying and flashing their abdomens.
I've censored this, obviously, hoping to attract mates. But like many flying insects, they might fly not towards a mate, but into a spider web. And when they do, it's usually lights out.
Mm-hmm.
But researchers at Tsinghua University in Taiwan actually observed something different. And here the researchers saw that a sheet web spider was capturing fireflies in their webs and leaving that firefly there for up to an hour. So the firefly would continue to emit its light, but the spider would just leave it be. And the researchers even observed that the spiders would go and check on the captured fireflies from time to time, but not eat them. And intrigued by this unusual behavior, the researchers then set up an experiment to test whether this strategy was being used by the spiders to increase their hunting success. And in this experiment, They placed LEDs, so not actual fireflies, but little lights that mimicked fireflies. And what they found is that the webs that had these LEDs in them were bringing in three times the number of insects. And when they checked those insects that were coming in, a lot of them were fireflies.
I see. So they reckon the spiders worked this out on their own as well.
Well, they also observed that the spiders would walk up and assess the prey. If it was a moth, they'd eat it straight away.
Mm-hmm.
But if it was a firefly, they'd leave it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So, yeah, they're thinking that actually the spiders here are intentionally using the fireflies as bait.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very interesting.
But if that brings us back to glowworms, so we don't have fireflies in Aotearoa, but it did make me wonder if we've got clusters of spiders hanging around near glowworms.
Yeah, could they do the same thing with the glowworms?
I would love to find out.
Well, I hope not for the glowworms' sake. Keep them safe from the spiders. Yeah, sweet. That is all of our topics for today. Thank you so much for joining us. That is the end of Dear Science for today. Thank you, Daniel, again, for joining us. Thank you to MOTAT, and thank you, Science.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.